You're listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Story is
everything.
We're giving Bobby Bell, and Bobby really wants to hold something up.
Yes. If you're just joining us, normally, of course, the Hot Texas Swing Band kicks us off, but tonight we chose a short clip. Y'all remember this music from Whipped Cream and Other Delights, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass? There is a reason that we picked this music. Let's bring on our special guest. There she is. Hey, Kathleen. This is Kathleen M. Rogers. And I know you pulled out this album earlier today, too, didn't you?
I did. And that music is in two different chapters in the novel. I didn't use any of the words, of course. Just referenced it.
And we are talking. This is our featured guest. Jim is going to introduce her in a moment. We are so delighted to have her with us. This is Kathleen M. Rogers. She is the writer of this book that you absolutely must read, The Flying Cutterbucks. You will just take off and soar, and she's not going to let you down. Welcome. Go ahead.
Okay, we have a short bio. There'll be a lot of things Kathleen will fill us in on. She's born in the Land of Enchantment. Yeah, she's a novelist who worked at Land of Enchantment, New Mexico.
Yes, folks. New Mexico.
Kathleen Rogers is a novelist who worked, has appeared in Family Circle Magazine, Military Times, and in several anthologies. Tonight we'll be talking about her fourth novel, The Flying Cutterbucks. She has received a number of awards, and one particular Women Zia Book Award for New Mexico Press. She's a native of Clovis, New Mexico. She resides in North Texas, where she's working on her fifth novel. Please welcome Kathleen. Hi, Kathleen.
Oh. Hi. Thank you, Jim and Bobby Jean. It's great to be here.
We're so delighted that you're with us. And as Jim remembers, you, of course, every time we had you on the writer's block with Jim Christina, Richard Polinelli, to discuss this book and others, and I'm just emotional. I'm so sorry. I don't know why, but we were just delighted to have you join us on Rendezvous with a Writer. This book, because you've been a guest before, for me this was a second read through, and I didn't want it to end. There were so many wonderful things I'd kind of forgotten, which can happen, and things that spoke to me this time that maybe, you know, didn't speak to me the last time. Jim, this was your first time through.
That's true.
And did you enjoy it?
I did.
So, Kathleen, tell us a little bit more about yourself and then maybe what inspired this story.
So I did. I grew up in Clovis, New Mexico, the third one down out of six kids. I married a fighter pilot from Cannon Air Force Base, and off we went into the wild blue yonder. I declared myself a writer when I was 15 years old, working on the high school newspaper, the Purple Press. Yes, we called it the Purple Press. My class changed the name. Class of 76, bicentennial. Writing has always been part of me, and I'm going to be 65 in October, so I've been doing this a while. I started out, I worked as a cub reporter for the Clovis News Journal. I did some student writing down at Eastern New Mexico University, and they've kindly invited me back in November for their third MediaCon, where I meet with students about what it's like to be a book writer. But I wrote for Family Circle, Military Times. I just tried to build up my bylines or portfolio. But I always wanted the novel because I love the long story form. My first novel took 16 years. The Flying Cutterbucks is my fourth. I do believe it's my bravest book because I set it against the backdrop of the 2016-2020 presidential election. And I'm not a political animal per se, but just some things happened and that's where I needed to, that was the big picture. And I dropped my story people into that behind that background, into the fictional town of Pardon, New Mexico.
The opening with whipped cream from that wonderful Herb Alpert album, Whipped Cream and Other Delights. And you mentioned it is in the book in a couple of different chapters. Tell us a little bit about, you've just shared that it's set in 2016, but it's also grounded in the 70s. And of course, that album came out in 65. But this family, the Cutterbucks, with long, deep roots and really fabulous family members, tell us a little bit about why that piece of music and from that time period and how it plays a role in this story.
So there's a... So, you know, it's a dual timeline. Some crucial things happened in the family kitchen there in the family home in Pardon in 1974. And then in 2016, I bring one of my protagonists, Trudy Cutterbuck, has returned back to Pardon. She's taken an early retirement from Southwest Airlines. She's a retired flight attendant. She's gone home to help her mother, Jewel, declutter a house full of mementos. Jewel has been a widow. Actually, her husband went to Vietnam as an F-4 fighter pilot and went missing in action in 72, and his body has not been found. And so Trudy's there. And the reason the music is important, there's a scene later in the story, and this doesn't give away the plot, but Trudy gets her elderly mother, Jewel, to, hey, let's dance. And they put on some of this music. And some of it might remind some of our viewers of The Dating Game. Remember, you know, The Dating Game. And I needed a fun piece of music that so many people might recognize, especially Bobby Jean, you and I. If we were in the same high school, we would have known each other, because we're the 70s chicks, and I still like the word chicks. But oh my God, I would get up, and my husband bought me the CD to that because the album, my uncle George, it was his album I inherited. He died young, and somehow we got that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's a scandalous cover.
Oh, I know. My mother was like, Bob, what are you bringing home, when my dad brought that home?
And I had fun using the cover and describing it. And Trudy and her mother in 2017 discussing, you know, there might have been some good churchgoers if the preacher's coming over for lunch. Oh, hide the cover out of them, you know. But I needed a fun piece of music there. And then at the closer to the end of the story, another one of Herb Albert's pieces was called Rise. Oh, my God. And so when I was writing that, I put the music on, play over and over. I would get up. I would dance around my office. I'd do anything to get into character.
Yeah. And she describes Trudy is working with her mom, as you say, kind of decluttering. And it's a very fun that Trudy has gone home with that in mind, but not resentful that she's going to do that. Like some of us maybe are not so excited about spending time helping our parents downsize or declutter if they're getting ready to maybe move. it's sort of a chore. And I really liked that Trudy wasn't, she was looking forward to this time with her mom and the sort of girl time together. And she really attacks it in a lovely way. She's, you know, she's cleaning the tile and she's really getting down to it. And her mom is it's not that she's grateful, but she's open and she's willing, you know, to go along with it. And they find that beautiful is like a Navajo rug or blanket that's over this piece of, you know, she's no, Trudy doesn't remember. It's like a table. And when she removes that and there's that big hi-fi stereo, and that's what we had. We had a Magnavox for years and years and years. And my dad was so proud of bringing that home, and her album came with it. I mean, the little record album collection that they had. So I felt as a reader, like, oh, I'm right there with you.
You know, and even the dog, even the Zia, the dog that they have adopted that just kind of mysteriously shows up under the flagpole in front of the house. Even Zia gets up and dances.
Dances is very fun. Well, the girls have been talking, so
let's talk about Shep.
Let's talk about Shep.
The main character here who actually has a silent role.
But a big role.
Yes, he's kind of off stage, if you will. Yeah, Shep is Major Shep Cutterbuck, and he went missing in action, as I said, in Vietnam in 1972. And he's still a very much a part of this family in that all of his flight suits are still hanging in a closet in jewels in his wife's bedroom. Pictures of Shep are everywhere. He was a military man. And of course, when he went missing, even though they didn't have any remains up until a point after so many years, you know, they declared him dead. But the Cutterbuck gals never thought of him as dead, and because they just couldn't. And the magical realism or mysticism part of the story is at very key moments in this novel, whether it's 1974 in the kitchen during a horrible thing that's going to happen, or in 2016, Trudy hears, as clear as a bell, her dad's voice. She hears Shep's voice in the form of radio, pilot radio commands. And those commands are almost like an order. Like he's telling her, this is what you need to do.
Right.
And Trudy is not a fighter pilot, but she was a girl. And when all those squadron parties were happening on her parents' patio back when they were teens and tweens, they listened in. They could hear all the fighter pilots talking, and they always talk with their hands because they're flying with their hands. So she would have heard all those pilot commands. Yeah. And it's up to the reader. Does Trudy really hear the radio commands? Is that really? Or is it in her memory? So I left that up to the reader. Well,
You were a reader. What did you think?
You know... Yeah, I understand that with Trudy. You know, but I do have a question, you know, regarding Shep. You know, he's been missing in action, and finally the War Department declares him dead. You know, and I'm thinking Jewel, his wife, handles it very well. But we're talking a lot, you know, decades of time going by. And I wonder, how do we, as other people, how can we ever feel what she feels? And I know you know somebody that went through something similar, because otherwise, they think, he's dead. Well, wait a minute, no, he's not quite dead. Yeah. Well, we haven't found him. We won't find him. Mm-hmm. And all I'm saying is, the average person, I don't think, going to have the empathy for the situation.
Thank you, Jim. That's a really good point. I do think let's say civilians away from the military, let's say someone, a loved one has been missing, no matter what age, and they are not found. There's no body. There's no evidence that they're alive somewhere. There's always, always that longing and wanting to know what happened. And we've all, or if we, I lost a little brother 40 years ago, we don't know, we will never know why his car left the road. Mm-hmm. We don't, we will never know the answers. So with mm-hmm. Shep, I wanted to explore what that would be like. I'd written about so many other situations in the military, but I'd never written about an MIA. And I talked to two different family members who had lived through this. And the saddest part in real life, one of the family members, the mom, she's long gone now. She died never knowing mm-hmm. what exactly happened to her son when he went to Vietnam. So I did do my homework. I did mm-hmm. interview different people. I asked a forensic scientist a lot of questions about DNA yeah. because that perhaps comes up. And I didn't get too detailed. I would worry about all that. And then finally, it's just like, don't ever analyze.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Trudy and Jewel and Sister George and Aunt Star, they don't need to know all the signs, although Aunt Star is a retired nurse. But,
you know, when you were researching what it's like to be a fighter pilot, it didn't seem like you had to go very far. Isn't that what your husband was?
Jim, I've been living with a fighter pilot almost 44 years. And yeah, he's been retired from that flying job. Then he flew for the airlines. But you know what? Once a fighter pilot, always a fighter pilot.
You know, there are things. I think originally you had sort of a different working title as you were working on the book. And and then I think you told us that Shep sort of made himself known to you.
I was driving along, going to an appointment one day. I didn't really have anything written on the story. I was daydreaming the story. And I had my character, Trudy. I really didn't know too much about her. And I'm driving, minding my own business. And out of the blue, I'm driving my old red Suburban, which I don't have anymore. And out of the blue, a voice says, "Major Shep Cutterbuck, I went missing in action in Vietnam in 1972, and I'm the patriarch, and I'm Trudy's dad." And I'm like, whoa, No. I've already written about fighter pilots in my first novel. Goodbye, you don't belong here. And he insisted. And then I'm like, okay, you're in.
What's your story, man? You got my full attention. Then, write it down.
And then once Shep said, it's like I had part of my framework. It's like I had, because a book is, to me, I picture it like a picture frame. Yeah. Yeah. And then the story inside this is really like a photograph.
Right, right.
In words.
These are four exceptional women, and there are more than the four, but the Cutterbuck women particularly, four exceptional women, couple different generations, but very, very tied together. This is not a dysfunctional family at all. They have great love and respect for each other, even though they've gone different ways and they're not all living in the same community, as many of our families are like that. Tell us a little bit, we're going to take a break in a moment, but tell us maybe a little bit about how did the four, you had Trudy initially, how did the other women reveal themselves to you?
Aunt Star came to me fairly early. I didn't quite know she was going to be an old activist, but I knew she was in the kitchen in 1974 when she was there and little Georgia was 13 on the dance team. Trudy is almost 15, a majorette. She walks in the side door and comes upon an incident, and there was a creepy cousin, Dub. And that is in chapter 2, and that's a I wrote that. It's past. It's a story in 1974, but I wrote it present tense to make it very, to give it a sense of urgency. Mm-hmm. So Aunt Star is both, at early on, I thought of her more as kind of an antagonist, kind of, you know, she won't tell Trudy certain things in 2017. Trudy wants answers. What really happened, Aunt Star, in 1974 in that kitchen when we were all there? And what really happened to Dub? Mm-hmm. And so that is a secret. And we find out perhaps late in the novel, although it's never really said, Aunt Star likes to kind of talk in riddles.
Yes, she does. Like lots of our aunts. I can remember driving with my folks and visiting grandparents and my mom and my grandma sitting in the back seat. And it was unusual for me to be up in the front seat, but the two of them would be in the back and they'd be talking really softly. And so if you said, what are you all talking about? They'd be like, oh, nothing you need to be, you know, concerned about. I've always wondered all these years, what were they talking about in that backseat?
Family secrets, Bobby Jean.
Family secrets. We are having a wonderful time talking with our friend Kathleen M. Rogers. This is her book, The Flying Cutterbucks. We're going to take a very short moment to show you where you can get this book and her others. And when we come back, I believe we'll introduce her again, and then she's going to read something from the book. So stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shops Bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com. Find books and CDs on the menu. Choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer with special guest Kathleen Rogers and the Flying Cutterbucks.
You get to soar with them in this book. Kathleen is, we asked if she would want to read something, and I am so delighted that she will, because I think as listeners tonight or watchers tonight, to be able to hear the lovely, fabulous prose that she writes, it'll give you a little bit of a taste of what it lies ahead for you when you open this book. We'll turn it back over to you, Kathleen.
Thank you very much. It's a short reading, maybe 2.5 minutes. Let me set it up. Trudy is our protagonist. She is in her late 50s. She's out in her mother's backyard with her dog, Zia, the big yellow dog she rescued. Trudy had a dream she woke up from that morning, and she's trying to analyze the dream. So I'll just start reading. The dream that woke her at sunrise returned. As she walked to the edge of the patio to keep an eye on the dog, the dream reeled through her mind like an old memory. Wanting to capture it in writing, to help her make sense of it, she pulled out her smartphone, opened the Notes app, and began thumbing the keys on her screen. Alone, on the shoulder of a steep mountain road, I stood in the bend of a hairpin curve and searched the deep canyon below. All I could see for miles were large boulders dotted with prickly pear cactus and the occasional glint of metal from some long ago wreck. Then from somewhere behind me, the sound of children singing, 99 bottles of beer on the wall, echoed through the mountain pass. Whipping my head around, I watched Mama's station wagon careen around the curb in the road and sail over the side of the mountain. But instead of crashing into the canyon below, the station wagon sprouted wings and rode the thermals across a tranquil sky. As the sound of children's voices faded, and I longed to join them, a passenger door flung open and Bogey tumbled out. From my spot on the road, I thrust giant arms skyward, for I was the big sister, and it was my job to catch him. But no matter how far I stretched, I couldn't reach him, for my arms weren't long enough. When I woke up, my eyes leaked with tears, and Zia stared at me from her spot on the bed where she rested her chin on my belly. After pressing done, Trudy looked up from her notes and blurted into the cold air, "It's not my fault, Daddy. I followed your orders. I tried to protect him, but that ugly little tumor was bigger than all of us. Even the gods in white coats couldn't save him."
Very good.
Yeah, it's a very powerful passage, and it is does connect to some of the mystical. I felt as a reader there was mystical elements throughout the book,
right.
And they softly approach. You're kind of almost caught unawares, perhaps.
And of course, that's the story of losing a younger brother.
Yeah.
There's a different tragedies in this movie.
We think it should be a movie. Netflix, hello, Taylor Sheridan, are you listening?
Loss. I explore loss.
Yeah.
It's part of our lives. It's a big theme in everything I've written, practically.
Yeah. But there's also found. And we have Trudy reconnecting with the young man that she dated in high school. And we just love him, Clay Cordova. Oh, my gosh. Oh my goodness, what a young man he was, I think, at the time, because they go their separate ways, but there's no animosity. There's no, they kind of reconnect almost where, their lives took separate pathways. You have some wonderful men, of course, Shep, we've talked about. Tell us, who is the orange cheese, she calls him the orange cheese puff. Who is that in this story?
That's a silent character.
So let me just say this. I was able to write about him. I never mentioned his name, and I never mentioned the other candidate. I never mentioned her name.
True.
So unless someone's been living on another planet.
Yes, and this particular personality is still very much in the mainstream, surprisingly, in a way. You kind of think that perhaps, time would have marched on. But is that partly why, and I think you said in the beginning that this is one of the bravest pieces of work you've done, because you do get into some issues.
Because so many reasons. Before the election, November 2016, some things really got to me as a military spouse. I'm older now, and a military mama, because I had a son that went to Afghanistan, and his best friend and his roommate from Officer Candidate School was killed in Afghanistan. So when a certain person disrespected a Gold Star family, I'm like, oh my God. Mm-hmm. No. And then all of the different charges about sexual assault, sexual harassment. And as a woman, it just got to me, and I had to figure out how to write it. And even now, even though the story ends on the eve of the 2020 election, I would say, here we are 3 years out, for anybody that hasn't read the Flying Cutter books, I do believe my novel is still very relevant, because look what's happening now. Women's rights, it's still a battle, not just in America, United States, around the world. Like, come on. I mean, I mean, how? What do we have to do? And Aunt Star helped me and Loopy Boleyn. She owns the local diner, for anyone who's read the book. Those are my two rah-rah-ree activists. And Loopy and Aunt Star helped me, not just me as the writer, but me as a woman in America. They helped me find my inner activist. Mm-hmm. And I marched in a local women's march here in Texas in January 2017. And I was joined by my combat decorated fighter pilot, Tom. He wore his leather jacket from Air Force days. He wore a cap from his American Airlines days. So he had it all going. And
There are a variety of themes. And I think, again, as a reader, it was very engaging the way the themes all work together, and there is resolution at the end, and surprises and twists and turns and things that you don't necessarily expect. You even have a whole section. We go to Las Vegas, New Mexico, and you have a whole section even about the Harvey girls. And yeah, and we're like ready to go take that trip.
Oh, you, Bobby Jean, you and Jim need to, where you live, it's not that far.
Yeah.
I set three chapters in Las Vegas, New Mexico. There, for those who haven't been, there are over 900 historic buildings in that town. I love Las Vegas, New Mexico. I love Taos, but I love Las Vegas, New Mexico. There's an historic plaza. It's kind of oval shaped. On the plaza is the historic Plaza Hotel. So there's key scenes that take place there. And then the Castaneda Hotel was a trackside Harvey House hotel. And in real life, my grandmother, her name was Olga Berg. She left Iowa at the age of 19. And she went to Kansas City, got interviewed to become a Harvey girl. And that was her first duty station, if you will. And Harvey girls were glorified waitresses, if you will. But there were all these rules. They had to be single. And my grandmother was stationed there for 2 years before she transferred to the Boleyn Harvey House. But I always wanted to write about Harvey girls, but I don't write historical fiction. I don't feel comfortable doing that. I had to figure out a way to incorporate Harvey girls into my contemporary fiction. So Tom and I went to Las Vegas in 2017, got a private tour of the Castaneda right before it started undergoing renovation. So I walked through that whole hotel. So when my characters walk through there, I actually have been there. I tapped into a few spirits, you know.
Mysticism again. Yeah. And there's an important scene that happens there as well. We get to spend some time with Trudy's sister and her character actor husband, or I guess boyfriend at that time. And they're quite a fun couple. But Trudy has an unexpected opportunity there to speak with another female character. Do you want to take a moment and talk about?
Are you talking about Aunt priest, Star?
No, the priest, Gracie.
Oh, okay.
Am I in the wrong place?
After she and Georgia leave the Castaneda, because Georgia's a dancer and she teaches dance at the local college. Mm-hmm. Georgia is kind of a reenactor in that she dresses up a Harvey girl and can give tours. So they had a family member give them their tour when Georgia gave them their tour. But in the following chapter, they end up over at the historic plaza, and Aunt Star shows up on a bench, and Trudy, this is maybe the next day, and Georgia shows up, and Trudy confronts Aunt Star about the family secret, what happened in that kitchen with Cousin Dub in 1974, and I'm not going to give it away. And Aunt Star says a few things, takes her cane and makes a statement with her cane. And then Trudy goes into the Plaza Hotel and turns right down this one hallway, and she ends up in a room. And in real life, it's called the Old Library. And the only person in there in this scene was a female priest, an Episcopalian priest named Priest Gracie. And Trudy has a deep, almost confessional talk with Priest Gracie. And I really did talk to a real female priest named Gracie. And she gave me her blessings, and she since read the novel. And it was a very emotional scene for me. And regardless of what faith people are, but I think women will really appreciate that scene.
Well, I've been doing all the talking as normal, honey. So I know you have things you want to bring up.
I want to switch a little direction a little bit. I wanted to ask a little process here. You're a member of a lot of writing groups, but the Military Writers Society of America, what are those folks all about?
Oh my gosh, Jim, great question. Sure. I became a member in 2008. I went to my first conference in Orlando, Florida in 2009. Mm-hmm. Military Writers Society of America, and it's a mouthful, so sometimes we just say MWSA. The founder is Bill McDonald. He is a decorated Vietnam veteran. He founded the organization or society over 20-something years ago, and he wanted to give veterans a voice and writing to heal. So that's still a very important mission. I've never worn a uniform, but I have been a family member. And so you don't have to have served, although I think military spouses do serve, but you don't have to have served. You can be a total civilian and join as long as you respect the military. This is not politics. It's you respect the military. And so anyone can join as long as you respect and honor the military. I'll be going to New London, Connecticut in September. We're having our annual conference. We were going to have it there in 2020 and again in 2021. And with COVID, everything got canceled. So last summer we had it in New Orleans. So we're finally, I've never been to Connecticut. So we're going to go to Connecticut for the conference. But I've made some lifetime friends there. Just good folks.
And I think you're also a member of Women Writing the West.
Oh my gosh. I should have joined years ago.
Yeah, we haven't joined yet. We need to join that organization as well. So tell us a little bit about that group. And I know their conference is coming up in October.
Right. It's going to be a virtual conference this year. Last October, I went to my first in-person Women Writing the West in Oklahoma City. And there again, I just connected. I met gals that I'd only known online, and it was like almost like this big sisterhood. And the beauty of all these writing organizations, we're all at different levels. No one's competing against each other. We're there to help each other. And I was going to say, I was on your website earlier and I saw all the list of organizations that you're members of. I'm like, yeah, Women Writing the West.
Well, and we've known so many members of that organization over the years. Right. We've just been slow to actually say, count us in. But we've been supporters in all of our time of talking with
and
members.
Jim can be a member. Jim, you can join too.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Women Writing the West, really?
Yeah, you come along with me.
I see. You know, Kevin, when do you find time to write?
Yeah.
And you have a particular spot you like to write in.
So, oh my gosh, I have a great office. So these are some bookshelves. When my boys are in, you know, their 30s now, but when my boys were little, I couldn't wait to and moving around the military, I couldn't wait to have my own little space. Found this house. I've lived in this house 31 years. I used to come in this room and hide, close the door, you know, whenever I could. And now I have the greatest office, but a lot of times when I'm writing, you know where I'm back at the kitchen table.
Are you?
There you go.
Because okay. It's the center of my house. The dogs are right there. You know, it's close to snacks, water.
Yeah.
But when I don't like set like 8 to 9. Now I used to have to keep office hours when I was a young mother. Things have changed. I'm a grandma now. When my grandson was just here last week, no, I didn't get any writing done, but I took him to the library.
Yeah.
When I'm focused on a story, I can't really read outside except for research. I like worry my stories into being, and then it's like, oh my gosh, she's been in her PJs, you know, 2 days in a row.
Well, and I think COVID did that to a lot of folks too. Yeah, you know, even if they were reporting through Zoom meetings or whatever, you know, maybe the top was, you know, looks and the bottom, you know, was something different. And I think it's taken folks a little while to get readjusted to, you know, we're all live everywhere we go now, you know?
Yeah.
Do you, did these characters, surprise you? Did you sometimes want them to go another way? And they said, not going that way.
Every character surprised me. I'll tell you what surprised me. About 12 chapters in, I had one of my first readers, Arlene, reading it. And she said, you know, Kathleen, call me anything. You really need to balance out this story. And so I came up with one of my characters. He's kind of secondary, but I love him. His name is Hector.
Hector
Cordova, and he's Clay's cousin. Hector had been in the Marines, and he owns his own remodeling business now. So Hector is going to come and help Jewel with her kitchen and some other areas. And he surprised me by a conversation that he ends up having with Trudy in the home around the election time. And he really surprised me. And what surprised me too was Trudy's reaction. And I thought they had a grown-up,
very authentic talk. Conversation. Yeah, very authentic conversation. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally get that. Do you, what about time? Oh, I'm looking at time. Are we? Is that what we're doing? We're looking at time. Oh,
we're
going to take one very, very short break, and in about 30 seconds, we're going to be back with Kathleen. Let's hear a little bit about Out West Shop, and we'll be right back.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
And we're back. Jim always has a couple quotes, and we want to get them in before we're suddenly off the air. So, Jim, what have you got?
Well, first one is from the book. And actually, we talked about, we just talked to Ted about our priest, Gracie.
Mm-hmm.
Love has no need, this is from Trudy. Love has no need to settle scores. Priest Gracie's words darted in front of her as she made her way down the hall. But what happens when love is used to manipulate others? Trudy wished she'd asked the priest. Our second quote, and we brought this fellow up here sort of in a couple sentences, is Senator John Glenn. And this is from part of John Glenn's commencement address to the Ohio State University graduating class of 2009. Love is a combination of friendship, passion, and respect. We are more fulfilled when we are involved with something bigger than ourselves. Fear connotes something that interferes with what you are doing. When you're a combat pilot, you believe you're the best in the air.
I respected him. My husband, I had a lot of respect for him.
Yeah. So Trudy, what do you, Trudy.
She's right here. Trudy, hurry.
Trudy, she probably is.
Trudy, what is Kathleen working on next?
She probably is.
I have, so my fifth novel, it's finished. My agent told me I could say this. So the fifth novel is set in Eastern New Mexico. And my agent says it's okay to say that an offer is likely forthcoming by the end of August. And those details are being ironed out before we can go public. So fingers crossed for a publisher.
And then return date with us in 2024, perhaps.
That would be so much fun. Let's just say this. The novel is set in Mexico again. You have mermaids as a theme, but it's not that kind of mermaid. But because New Mexico is what? It's a landlocked state. We don't have any oceans or, you know, things surrounding us. So water is a big part of it. Books, libraries, librarians, and independent bookstores.
Oh, we love
and
that.
The love of literature.
Oh, that
and
sounds great.
Sisters and friendship and the guidance of this incredible woman named Letty Hubbard, who's the mom. And so I'm very, very hopeful for this book. There is no military in this book. My husband gave me permission 2 or 3 years ago. I said, I'm trying to figure out how to get military in the book. He goes, babe,
maybe
you
not.
Don't have to. I've done it. I did it in Family Circle magazine. I did it in almost everything. But yeah. I've served.
Yeah. Yes, you have. We've been talking with Kathleen Rogers. And one more time, The Flying Cutterbucks. This is a wonderful book. You need to read this. We're going to just take a moment and announce next week, Paris Afton Bonds joins us with her newest book, Answering the Call. And just as we enjoyed Kathleen with us on the Writer's Block every time, Paris is near and dear to my heart in the same way. So we're very excited that she'll be with us. And I think that we are going to say thank you so much for being with us tonight. And thank you to Sam and LA Talk Radio and to the Hot Texas Swing Band, whose music is going to take us out. And we will see you next week. It's always a great day out west.
Listening to Rendezvous with the Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.